And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Our scheduled guest for today's morning show was forced to cancel. So we've gone to the morning show archives for actually a relatively recent conversation from early in 2024 that I think you will enjoy. As somebody who absolutely loves to read, with sagging filled bookshelves all over my house and office, I always appreciate the opportunity to read a book that celebrates books, and also that celebrates and seeks to defend the right for all of us to read what we choose to read. And in a time when that very basic fundamental right seems to be under assault, there are a number of books that have been written that seek to address this in one way or another, and to remind all of us about the importance of books in our lives and in our collective life together. One that has just crossed my path that I am so excited to talk about is a book called The World in Books, 52 Works of Great Short Nonfiction. It is the work of one Kenneth C. Davis, a best-selling author many times over. Perhaps you have encountered a whole series of books, the titles of which begin, "Don't Know Much About," and then what ensues then is a book about the Bible or the U.S. presidents or any number of other topics. He has a number of other books to his credit, including Great Short Books, A Year of Reading Briefly, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives, and a number of other works. This most recent book, published by Simon & Schuster, again is titled The World in Books, 52 Works of Great Short Nonfiction. And Kenneth C. Davis, we welcome you to the morning show.
It is great to be with you, Greg. Thanks for having me. Great to be on with Wisconsin Public Radio. As we said off air a moment ago, I'm an old friend of Wisconsin Public Radio, so it's a pleasure to be with you. And thanks for that very lovely introduction. I have lived a life in books from childhood. Books have been my passion, and most people, as you mentioned, might know me for a book called Don't Know Much About History, for instance, which came out more than 30 years ago. I can't believe it when I say it, but that book, like all of my books, I think is about continuing our education well past school, becoming lifelong learners, and The World in Books continues that tradition.
I love that. I love that. I happen to give periodic music lectures to a local group, the name of which is Adventures in Lifelong Learning, and I think that is a wonderful principle or concept to embrace wholeheartedly. And yes, your books, among others, are certainly one means to do that. Ahead of us talking about The World in Books, I would love to hear more about this so-called life in books that you have lived, your lifelong love of reading and books. Growing up, what kind of books are we talking about? And tell us more about the place that books have always had in your life, but especially early on.
Okay, absolutely. When I was a kid, I was one of those kids who had, I can remember physically, the books in the bottom of my bed. Now, some of them were golden books. You know, I remember very clearly Mickey Mouse Delivers the Christmas Mail, a golden book that I read numerous times. But there was another book that I was very, very fond of, a little bit older, I suppose, and it was called Minute Biographies. And minute biographies were exactly what they claimed to be. You could read the life of a famous or infamous person in a minute. So I was very early on interested in the idea of lives of famous people, biographies, looking at them as real people. But I also learned early on that short can be beautiful. So that book was well-read in my childhood. I grew up in a town that had no bookstore, Mount Vernon, New York, just outside of New York City. But it had a magnificent library, one of those Andrew Carnegie gifts to the nation. And I was there truly, I would say, every week. I remember the day of graduating from the children's room on the bottom floor to go up to the adult stacks, and you actually walked up this marble staircase, and it was like going into a temple. So I always had that that sense of something bigger than myself going into the library. I had wonderful school libraries when I was a kid. Then when I got into college, I stopped halfway out and took a job in a bookstore. And being a lover of books, it was a great place to work. But I also met someone who read my college writing. I never had any dreams of being a writer, just as I didn't think I could be an astronaut or a neuroscientist. But this woman read my college work, and she said, you know what, you're wasting your time selling books. You should be writing them. She was so smart, I married her. And and we have together, she went on to become an editor herself and a book agent. So we've lived a life in books, in publishing. My very first book, published in 1984, that very remarkable year, was called Two-Bit Culture, The Paperbacking of America. And it was a description of how paperback books came into onto the scene in the late 1930s, early 40s, really a post-war phenomenon then, and really changed reading in America because most people had never had access to books before the paperback came along. They were all priced at 25 cents, hence the title, Two Bits, Two-Bit Culture. And I really talked about, in that book, the consequence of books, and I talked about the censorship of books, which is something I'm sure we'll come back to. So this book now brings me full circle to the beginning of my career. This is a book about books, just as my previous book, Great Short Books, was. That was about 58 short novels. This is about 52 works of short nonfiction, all of them short enough to read within a space of a week. So that's why 52 of them makes another year of great reading.
Love it. Let me ask you one other thing from your life with books and something in your biography, if you will, and that is this moment when you began reviewing books as a reviewer for Publishers Weekly, where your wife worked, I think, and so you had that connection. But I wonder what it was like for you as someone who had always loved to read, but I presume had never sat down to write a serious review of a book, or maybe you had, at least from time to time. But it seems to me that reviewing books is different from reading books. Obviously, they're tightly connected, but they're also two very different experiences. What did it feel like for you to step into that role as a reviewer of books?
Well, first of all, it felt a little like nirvana. Here I was reading books and getting paid to do it, so it was rather extraordinary. I should mention that back then, and we're talking about the late 70s into the early 80s, I was receiving the princely sum of $10 a review, $15 if it was a little longer book. And I, of course, had to go through a testing experience to see if I had the right chops for it. But it essentially was, you know, doing what I had always done in my life, whether it was writing a book report in elementary school or college, and doing the same thing. Publishers Weekly is a magazine that is for the book trade, but it's very influential, and it often reviews books before they're actually published. So I was in the position of starting to read and review books before their publication. And I was very, very fortunate. Over time, I got to read some really important pieces of mostly fiction that were, I think today we would call them modern classics. For instance, Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie. I was the first trade reviewer on that book, and in fact, my review was then published on the back of the first edition of the hardcover, because these reviews came out before the book did. And so that's a moment of great pride. My name wasn't on the review, but that's because Publishers Weekly was anonymous in those days. So it was a great experience for me as a young writer. This was, you know, sort of paying my dues. I was doing this, but it also introduced me to a very important idea that I've tried to follow throughout my career. The nature of a publisher's weekly review was you had about seven sentences to encapsulate what the book was about, offer some description, and then a sentence or two of praise or not. So it was a good working experience for being a person who wanted to always write accessibly and short and concise. And that's what I've tried to do in my books when I went on from there. Don't Know Much About History. Yes, that was the first book in the series. Forgive me. Don't Know Much About History is, for those who are not familiar with it, a series of questions and answers about American history. And some of the questions are very straightforward. What does the Declaration of Independence declare? Others were a little more irreverent or quirky. Did Columbus's men really bring syphilis back to Europe from America? Why is there a statue of Benedict Arnold's boot? And I tried to answer those questions in a few paragraphs or pages. So this was a book that, as we talk about lifelong learning, was a way to refresh your shaky recollections of things you might have learned in school, or correct the misinformation you learned in school, or fill in the parts that the textbooks left out. That's always driven my work, is to find those stories, those very real human stories from history that school books often leave out.
Hmm. I don't remember how I happened to learn this, but I know that you come from a blue-collar family. And I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about that background, and to what extent you think that has played a significant role in the kind of writer that you are to this very day, and the kind of books that you have chosen to write.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't think anybody's ever asked it of me before in some 40 years of doing this. Yeah, my father was a World War II veteran. He'd driven trucks across North Africa and Italy during the war, and when he came back from the war, became a truck driver. That's what he knew how to do. And my years growing up, my father worked delivering first bread, and pies, and then the supermarkets came along and killed that business. And then he was delivering diapers. This was a day when you could get your diapers cleaned and delivered. And then, of course, Pampers came along and killed that. So I was very aware that life changes for many of us. My mother worked nights in the clerical department at Sears, and for people of a certain age, Sears was a very important name. I'm sure younger people never heard of Sears, but it was an American institution, Sears and Roebuck, one of the great first catalog stores, and then went into retail, and of course was finished off by the age of the internet and the big box stores and the like. So I was raised with a sense that you worked, and you worked hard, and you went to school and tried to do better. But for all of that blue-collar background, our house was, we didn't own any books, but it was always filled with books, always filled with newspapers. We got the newspaper delivered every day. We got a couple of news magazines delivered every week. And those things really shaped me as a writer. As I said, I loved to read as a kid. And both of my parents encouraged that spirit. We didn't own many books. Most people, 40, 50, 60 years ago, didn't own many books until the paperback came along and you could buy books more easily, unless you were in the Book of the Month Club, and then you really got one book a month. But that was a very, very different time in America.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Kenneth C. Davis, the author of many interesting and informative books, most recently the author of a book about books called The World in Books, 52 Works of Great Short Nonfiction. This book has just been published by Simon & Schuster. In some respects, this book should not come as any sort of surprise. I mean by that it is a very natural extension of quite a number of things you have already written. And yet I have to say that I was just delighted when I saw this title and thought, what a terrific idea, and how interesting that no one has, as far as I know, has done exactly this before. Tell us a little bit about the germ of this idea and a bit about how you went about putting it together.
Sure. Greg, first of all, I'll explain what people will find when they open the book, and then I can go back into how it came to be. Mm-hmm. This book is a collection of brief entries. Again, always the emphasis on brief, short. Brief entries on each of these books. I'm going to give you an excerpt from the book. I'm going to tell you what to expect in it, no spoilers, tell you a bit about the author, whether we know who it was or not, in some cases, legendary authors, why you should read it, and then what to read next. And I do that in about 4 or 5 pages for each of these 52 books. So it's really a way to whet the appetite of the reader, figure out why this book is of interest, why it's important, and why I should read it. Where I put my historian's hat on is in the biographies, because I'm very, very interested in the stories of the people who wrote these books and the times in which they lived. Very, very significant, of course. When you talk about someone like James Baldwin, whose book The Fire Next Time is in this collection, you can't talk about that book without talking about Baldwin's childhood growing up in a very, very racist America. And that's one of the reasons that the book is still timely. So that's what you'll find in the book. The reason I did this goes back to especially the pandemic. I found myself in the pandemic and the political chaos finding it difficult to concentrate, to focus. We were all doom-scrolling the news, of course. And I realized at a certain point I had to break away from that. And the way I did it was to start reading a little bit more than I had, even though I had been a reader all my life. I think, like a lot of people in the Internet age, I'd gotten away from it, especially during the pandemic. And so I started reading short books because short attention spans. I wanted to read something that I could get through relatively quickly and easily, but was still meaningful. That was the genesis of the previous book called Great Short Books, A Year of Reading Briefly, which is a collection of 58 short novels that I recommend and do the same thing for. A quick synopsis about the author, why read it, what's in it. After writing that, I decided to move on to the obvious corollary, which was 52 works of great short nonfiction. And these were books that range from the beginning of recorded time. Truly, the first book in the collection is The Epic of Gilgamesh, the first known recorded piece of literature. The Book of Genesis, which is the first book in the Bible. Many people think of the Bible as a book, but it is indeed a collection of many books. I focused on Genesis and later on in the collection on the book, the Gospel of Luke, one from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament, to give a sense of these foundational texts in Christianity, Judaism and Christianity.
What did it feel like as you were assembling this as this book took shape? I should think it felt, in some respects, sort of monumental. I mean, so much of it tied into who you are and the life you've lived and your life with books and so on. I mean, I can just scarcely imagine what this would have felt like to see this book take shape.
It was somewhat overwhelming, there's no question about it, but it was also a balm, as I talked about, that feeling of you know, anxiety, stress, anxiousness that many of us felt during the pandemic. I discovered that reading was really the antidote to that, not as an escape from the reality of the world, but as a way to remove myself from it, but still find insight, illumination. These are the things that books can give us. And reading is very good for us. We have studies that support that. It's good for helping you get to sleep. It's good for your mental focus. It's good to help you think. And if we need anything right now, it's thinking people who can think critically. That's one of the great problems of our time. So it's a great responsibility, of course. And obviously, this is a subjective book to take from the thousands and thousands of possibilities, 52 books, and of course I recommend many others in the course of The World in Books. But what I was looking for were, besides a short length, four very, very important ideas. Consequence. Was this book important in its time? Is it important in all time? And for instance, I would cite as an example John Hersey's Hiroshima, which is a book that influenced me profoundly as a teenager. It's enormous consequence in telling the story of six survivors of the first atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. The book came out in 1946, and Hershey wasn't writing about the science behind it or the politics or the military decisions. He was writing about the human lives of six people who survived this bomb. It is as important now as it was when it was published, and that's my second point, timeliness. I wanted to include books that, no matter when they were published or written, still speak to us today, and Hiroshima is a perfect example of that. And the third very important aspect of this is accessibility. Is the writing pleasurable? Is it easy to read? I didn't want to offer up jargon-filled academic texts. I wanted books that would still be not necessarily easy to read, but pleasurable to read and fulfilling to read. And Hersey's book is certainly among those. Another example, I just mentioned James Baldwin, his book, The Fire Next Time, written in 1963, of great consequence when it was published at that time, reflecting the civil rights movement and what was going on in the country then. But that book could have been written last week. And that's the timeliness question, because the issues of race and racism are as real and as powerful today as perhaps they were in Baldwin's time. And again, the reading is exquisite. Baldwin is one of the finest writers I have ever read, and I included him as a representative of what I think great writing can be.
Hmm. One of the impressive things about this book is its scope, although I suppose it could be argued that you could have extended your net even farther, I suppose, but I mean, one can scarcely imagine it, and yet, you know, the title is The World in Books, and this is not just a book of about American books and books that speak to the American experience, but really embrace at least a good portion of the planet. How much did you wrestle with that in terms of how wide the scope of this book should be, and in a sense, if this book should extend even beyond your own personal understanding of the books that have been published all over the planet?
That's a great question, Greg. Thank you. One of the things I really set out to do was to talk about books that really made the world, books that shaped the world that we live in today, as I mentioned, going back to the beginnings of recorded time, books from the early classical period, the Symposium by Plato, which, you know, when you hear Symposium, you think kind of tweedy guys sitting around smoking pipes and talking about high ideas. But Symposium actually could have been called Drunken Frat Party, because that's essentially what it was, a bunch of Athenian guys sitting around, or actually laying around on their couches, drinking and talking about sex. I mean, that sounds like a frat party to me, and that's essentially what it is. They were discussing on a very high level Eros, the Greek word for love, but also Eros, the god of love. So when you hear the book described as a drinking party instead of a symposium, it gives you a different sense of this, and that is a book that is a wonderful example of taking something that's short, very, very challenging to read and think about, but then you are introduced to the world of not only Plato, but Socrates, because Socrates is actually the central character in this story, and this is how He worked. He sat around with people and asked questions. We call it the Socratic method. And in asking and answering those questions, you learn something. And that's essentially what I'm trying to do with all these books, ask questions and get you to think and learn for yourself and think for yourself, because that's what education really should be. So my key criteria, as I mentioned earlier, were the consequence of these ideas and these writers, the timeliness, do they still speak to us today? The accessibility of the language, is it still a pleasurable book to read? I can tell you that there were a lot of books I started, maybe even finished, and decided not to include, even though they were important in their time, they talk about great important ideas, but the language is just a little bit too dated. It's, you know, missed its freshness date, as we would say about milk. Mary Wollstonecraft's book about women, written very early on in modern history, is an important book, but it's a real slog to get through. So by all means, read it if you like, but it did not fit my requirements for a pleasurable read. And the other big issue here is that certainly I was trying to address all of the important isms that we think of: sexism, racism, fascism, communism, socialism, and finally, perhaps most important, the question of climate change. There are several books that address the environment and environmental issues, and this is, of course, one of the key questions of our time.
One of the intriguing things about this lineup of 52 books is, in a sense, your understanding of the term nonfiction. That is, and I'm not, by no means am I taking issue with that, but I think some people may pick up your book and expect 52 books that align with, in a sense, a narrower understanding of what a nonfiction book is. I mean, the nonfiction books are mostly about biography of Mark Twain or wondrous creatures of the deep sea or something like that, and these books that you have gathered here are in a sense more than that, and I appreciate that. But I want to have you just talk for a moment about your understanding of what it means for something to be nonfiction, and just
sure,
what a vast world, in fact, that is.
Yeah, it's a very good and fair question. I appreciate it. I address it in part in the introduction to the book, because this applies mostly to the oldest books in the collection, books from the classical period. First of all, I had to address the fact that many of them were written in verse, poetry. So is poetry nonfiction? Well, in the ancient world, much of what was written in verse, so we have to, you know, set that aside. The first chapter of the book of Genesis is a beautiful poem, and so that's verse. Certainly, it's also fictional in the sense that these are stories, mythic stories, but to me, mythology is a sacred story. So one could call out the Epic of Gilgamesh, the book of Genesis, later on the Bhagavad Gita, as books of fiction, but they are also books of sacred stories that are foundational to world religions. And so I want to include them because I think it's very important that we understand where these books of faith come from, how they've influenced people. I mean, if you talk about consequence, Genesis is about the most one of the most consequential pieces of writing there is in Western civilization and beyond, the root of Judaism and Christianity. Same thing, I've included a selection from the Quran, a chapter called The Cow, which I think many, many Americans have never opened the Quran for themselves. And they'd be surprised when they open this and learn that this book, which is the sacred stories of Islam includes numerous references to Moses, Abraham, Jesus, and Mary. This would be a surprise, I think, to many Americans who've never explored what this book says, is, and means. And that's why I think to be an educated person, one must have an understanding of these foundational texts in world religions.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kenneth C. Davis, and we are talking about his newest book, which is called The World in Books, 52 Works of Great Short Nonfiction. This is a collection of, indeed, 52 works, all of them, if I remember correctly, essentially 200 pages in length or less, and spanning many, many centuries and many, many different nations and cultures. And it's an extraordinary journey to explore this book and all that it represents. I will say, in contrast to what you were just talking about, that my eyes lit up to see a couple of authors I have been honored to interview on my program represented in this collection, Barbara Ehrenreich and Michael Pollan. And in a sense, these would be examples of two books that most people would immediately recognize as works of nonfiction. And I think also their significance is pretty much undeniable. Nevertheless, I was really maybe a bit surprised and delighted that they were included in this important company. I would love to have you spend just a moment talking about these two authors and why they are here. And why don't we begin with Nickeled and Dimed?
Absolutely. They're both included because they are among my favorite nonfiction books, both a little, certainly much more contemporary than some of the books that we've been talking about. But that's one of my goals here, is to include nonfiction across a wide range of time.
Of course.
And right up to our contemporary times. Nickeled and Dimed, for those who don't know it, is by Barbara Ehrenreich. It was published nearly 25 years ago. And Ehrenreich was a journalist, although not by training. She became a journalist. And she decided, during a period when we were debating what was called then workfare, that people who were on welfare should be required to work, she decided to go out and take low-paying jobs and see what it was actually like to live, to work, and find a place to live on what was essentially poverty-scale wages. She has three sections in the book. The first, she works as a waitress in Florida. The second is going up to, I believe it was Maine, to work in a health facility, but also do home cleaning, and then finally to work in a Walmart. And it is the best of personal journalism. It is a landmark, I think. And she talked about this very essential problem of what it means to live from week to week, if even that. And, of course, written 25 years ago, the book is still as timely. Again, this is the question of consequence and timeliness, and of course the pleasure of the reading. It's a wonderful read. She has a sense of humor. She gets to know these people that she's working with. So that's why I think it is, in many ways, a modern classic. Michael Pollan's book, which is called Food Rules, is also a modern classic, I guess it's fair to say already. Why include a book that has 81 rules about what to eat? Because if we are talking about books as means to change how we see ourselves and see the world, what is more important than talking about what we eat? It is the most, perhaps most essential thing we do to stay alive, of course. Michael Pollan's book is fun, it's light, it's lighthearted, but it gets at some very, very serious subjects. That is, what we eat has a lot to do with the way we live. What we eat has an impact on the economy, and certainly the commercialization of the production of food and the availability of food in supermarkets is part of the world in which we live. And to add a point to it, Michael Pollan also talks about the fact that the way we grow and produce food has a real environmental aspect. So that's why this book, even though it's very lighthearted and fun to read, really gets at some very, very basic points about how we live, how we can change the way we live. And that's what most of these books are really about, looking at the way we live, looking at ourselves and wondering, can I do something different to make it better?
Anybody who knows anything about you will not be surprised that Frederick Douglass is represented in this company. He has been mentioned in at least a couple different of your previous books and is someone who you regard with deep admiration, as all of us should. Tell us why Frederick Douglass so securely belongs in this company of important writers from world history.
Well, if I make a personal pantheon of the great writers and people who influenced the course and the trajectory of American history, Frederick Douglass is very near the top of that list. For those who have never read Frederick Douglass, I include the first book in what was a trilogy of biographies, autobiographies, or memoirs. It's called The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. Basically explains his life being born enslaved in Maryland and to the time that he escapes and then uses his freedom to become the leading voice of abolition in America in the middle of the 19th century, a man who went from being enslaved to being a very, very important counselor, not always a friendly counselor to Abraham Lincoln. The book is riveting because it put a human face on slavery, which at the time was being discussed with terms like, you know, abolition and kind of political terms. Douglass put a human face on it. It's also a very important book, I think, in this collection because Douglass writes at a very talks about at a very young age understanding that he knew how the white man enslaved the black man, and it was through education. Douglass describes how his mistress, the woman who was the wife of his enslaver, was teaching him his ABCs, and he's about 8 years old at the time. The enslaver walks in, his name was Hugh Auld, and says, stop that right away. First of all, it's illegal. Second of all, you will ruin him. You will ruin him because education will ruin a slave. And Douglass understood it was this epiphanal moment that he knew he had to learn to read, and that was the route to his emancipation, the route to freedom. And I think that, you know, obviously it's, you know, speaking about emancipation from enslavement, but I think it still rings true to me today that learning and education are the keys to our freedom still. And so the narrative of Frederick, of the life of Frederick Douglass, is an essential reading, I think, for all Americans. I did not have to read it as a student when I was growing up, late 1960s, early 1970s. I only came to it later on as an adult, and I always thought it was practically criminal that this wasn't required reading for all American students.
I want to return to one matter in terms of the structure of the book that I really appreciate, and I know you mentioned it, but I want to just revisit it briefly, and that is the fact that as we read about each of these 52 important works of short nonfiction, each chapter begins with the opening words of that particular book. So, for instance, when we are reading about something as ancient as the Epic of Gilgamesh, the first thing we see essentially are the opening words of that work. I will proclaim to the world the deeds of Gilgamesh. This was the man to whom all things were known. This was the king who knew the countries of the world. He was wise. He saw mysteries and knew secret things. He brought us a tale of the days before the flood. He went on a long journey, was weary, worn out with labor. Returning, he rested. He engraved on a stone the whole story. I mean, it's probably maybe the single best example in the book of how enticing the opening words of a book can be. I mean, I've never read that entire work, but I didn't even have to read, you know, your summary of it. Those opening words have whetted my appetite and make me want to explore this book further. And I just wonder what your thinking was in having every chapter begin with the opening words of each work.
Well, this was a technique that I had used previously in great short books, because I think, you know, one of the keys to a great book is that it grabs you from the first page. It should grab you from the first sentence. And that's certainly key to the books I included, the novels I included in great short books. And here I did the same thing. I wanted to get to the essence of the book and why it's important, and often is right there in the first few words. Occasionally I did excerpts from later in the book to give that sense, but I often tried to start with the very first words. And this is a perfect example of, you use the word whet my appetite. That's what I'm trying to do here. This is a book buffet, this collection. The World in Books is like that great all-night diner where you can eat breakfast all day, but you can also get dessert at any time. So this is a book where you could actually read it straight through chronologically, and it would go from the beginning of time right up into our own times, or you can dip into it, and you can have dessert first. But whetting the appetite is really the idea here. I'm not going to tell you everything about these books. I want you to read them for yourselves. You might decide, well, that one sounds interesting, but I don't think I need to read it. But at least you'll be familiar with it. And these are also books that I consider stepping stones. So one doesn't sit down and decide they're going to read Dante's Divine Comedy, all three books of it, starting with the Inferno. But if you read Dante's Vita Nuova, which is included in this, you get a sense of who Dante is, that he describes his first meeting with Beatrice, La Beatrice, the woman who will inspire him eventually to go on and write Divine Comedy, and you'll get a sense of the life and times, the times in which Dante lived and was actually exiled from his native Florence, couldn't return under pain of death. So it's an extraordinary human story, but it also is a way to step into reading something much more ambitious. Hmm.
It is not an accident that you have written this book and released it to the world now, because you feel a sense of urgency about writing about books and our right to read what we choose to read. And you do tell us in the introduction to the book that the wave of censorship and book banning that we are seeing right now is, in a sense, nothing new. You say there is nothing new about censorship, but there is something new about this well-organized and highly partisan onslaught that at one other point in the introduction you call a purge of ideas. In our closing a minute or two, I wonder if you could just touch on this very deep concern that you obviously have about the climate in which we are living right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It was hovering over me as I was reading all of these books and writing all these books. Of course, many of the books that are included, many of the authors included in this collection, The World in Books, have been censored or banned or suppressed or burned in some cases. Voltaire's books were burned in Paris. Hemingway's books were burned in 1933, Berlin, as was the work of Helen Keller, who's included in this. And people might be surprised, why did the Nazis burn Helen Keller, this nice lady who was blind and deaf? Well, she was a socialist, a fairly radical socialist, and was a member of the Wobblies, the very radical union. She was a founder of the American Civil Liberties Union. She was a founder, early supporter of the NAACP. So when I write about Helen Keller, I want to tell people that there's much more to the story than the miracle worker. But the atmosphere right now is dangerous, and you're certainly right. It is very much a partisan, I would say, a white Christian nationalist movement that is trying to remove books, not because they're dirty, they don't have a few dirty words or a dirty scene or a bare breast, as in Mouse, which is one of the books that's under attack. They represent ideas that these people don't like. They fear these ideas, and so they suppress them because suppressing these ideas is the way they keep their power. And when I have written about dictators and autocrats and authoritarians, and one of the things I learned from doing that is when a dictator, a Mussolini or a Hitler, comes to power, the first thing they come for is the books. They put the writers in jail. Stalin did the same thing, of course. They start to tell you which books you can and cannot read. So this is a first step on the road to totalitarianism. And that's why it's so important for all of us to continue to support the freedom to read. We have a First Amendment freedom to speak, but the freedom to read goes along with that. A few, more than a few years ago, in 1982, I believe, the Supreme Court did give a ruling about the suppression of some books in a school district in Long Island, New York. And one of the things that the justices wrote was that the First Amendment doesn't stop at the school gate. That's something that we should remember, not just in terms of our students, but in terms of ourselves. When a few people can determine what books our children and we can read, we are in a very, very dangerous world. And that's why I think this is certainly part of the sermon that I preach in the world in books, because I believe that this is such a fundamental right, an important right, and the idea that we can suppress ideas is completely contrary to the notion of what democracy should be.
The book again is The World in Books, 52 Works of Great Short Nonfiction, published by Simon & Schuster, the author Kenneth C. Davis. Kenneth C. Davis, thank you so much for giving the world this truly important and fascinating book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a great pleasure. And people can learn more about me and my work at don'tknowmuch.com. That's my website. You can learn more about the books there.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Claudia Rowe, the author of a fascinating book called Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care. On Thursday, we will be hearing about the Four Seasons Garden Club, and we'll also be previewing the next production at the Racine Theater Guild, which is the musical Legally Blonde. And on Friday, a look ahead at the next American Experience documentary, which is called Mr. Polaroid, an examination of the fascinating life and career of Edwin Land, inventor of the Polaroid camera. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast is for mostly cloudy skies today, fog gradually giving way. We do have a slight chance of an afternoon rain shower. Our high today, 68 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elk.